So tonight we have three readings. The first reading is from our chapter in my new book, The Three Principles of Oneness, How Embodying the Cosmic Perspective Can Liberate Your Life. And we have been looking at chapter eight, and we have been going through the three principles. So let me begin with a reading by Thich Nhat Hanh. One included all, and all were contained in one. Our second reading is from the psychologist and scholar William James. The belief that there is an unseen order and that our supreme good lies in harmoniously adjusting ourselves thereto is the true definition of religion. And finally, from Pete Townsend, a song called I'm One. Every year is the same, I feel it again, I'm a loser. No chance to win. The leaves start falling, come down is calling, and loneliness starts sinking in. But I am one. I am one, and I can see that this is me, and I will be, you will all see, I'm the one. So I'm going to read the short description in the book of the third principle of oneness. From the delusion of separation, the universe is cold, disconnected, and void. From the spaciousness of oneness, it is an interdependent web of wonder. So the title of tonight's talk is, Who Do You Think You Are? Frightened Animal or Enlightened Human? Because when it comes right down to it, once we bear witness to what we can know about the universe, we have a choice. And that choice we make will affect everything else that we do or don't do. And that choice is to define who we are. Now, one of the things we learn from our teachings is that the way we have all been conditioned is to believe that our ego self is the only reality. The ego self begins at a certain point, goes through all kinds of different permutations, and then ends over here. And that this ego self, this skin bag, that is the only identity that is real. That's what we've been conditioned to believe. And when we look out into the immensity of our world and the incredible vastness of our universe, when we come from that perspective, it's pretty unsettling. Because we begin to question, well, if my existence starts here, like, you know, Tony started here in February of 1963, and at some point he ends here, if that's it, what's the point? What's the point to being alive? What's the point to trying to accomplish anything? What's the point of loving? And what I would offer is that this conditioning that we experience which is a natural product of our evolutionary process. I say that that view of the self isn't an honest one. It is not an accurate one. Rather, I would say that that view of the self is the height of hubris and arrogance. How arrogant of us to determine that life is meaningless. You know, it always amuses me when someone looks out into the universe, into the wonders of this world, and they say, the universe is meaningless. Well, if the person who's saying that has no meaning, how can what they're saying have any meaning? Isn't this just a cosmic version of the pot calling the kettle black? It's absurd. And it doesn't really meet with any of our experience as human beings. And I'm going to explore that with you tonight a little bit. It doesn't meet with the experience of our human story. And it does not meet with the experience and understanding of the knowledge we have about the universe at this time. What the third principle of oneness does is it says that this bounded, arrogant, hubris, ego self is not the whole story. That's a conditioned response that we have, and that conditioning response, which makes us think we're these little egos that are separate from everything else in the universe, living independently, and then at some point we disappear. The third principle of oneness offers us the idea or the concept of a humble holiness, a humble holiness of an unbounded self, of a sense of identity that goes beyond all human boundary. So in order for me to illustrate this experience, I'm going to go back in time. We're going to take a big cosmic perspective of our early evolutionary history. When we try to understand how our early human societies or groups began to do things that we might call our spiritual or religious, it's really hard to measure. We can go back with some archaeological evidence as far back as about 300,000 years. And 300,000 years ago, there seems to be evidence of maybe burials. And this Paleolithic period would have been a time when the planet was populated by different human species. And the burial sites that we found seem to belong to the Neanderthal group. But we're not sure about that because the Neanderthal burials are controversial. The Neanderthal burials, if they're burials, seem to indicate that the early tribes of these hunter-gatherers did not want to live in the same cave as their dead. So was that something spiritual, or was it rather because they didn't want to be living next to rotting corpses? That's one possibility. The other is, and this is the hardest part, and we can't prove any of this stuff one way or the other, but scholars tend to lean in this direction. It's quite possible that early Neanderthals practiced cannibalism, and cannibalism of their dead. So once that someone had died, their bodies were eaten. There's some evidence for this. And one of the things that anthropologists and archaeologists used to get excited about was the fact that you would find seeds and flowers and things like that in some of these cave sites. But the problem is that the the type of rodent that was popular there and would have been burrowing in and out of that area has the habit of carrying seeds and flowers into their burrows. So we don't know. So what I say is this, we really don't know what it was like up to a certain point. We can speculate, but we don't know. But what is clear is that about 100,000 years ago, some of the evidence that we found in some caves in Israel definitely, without question, demonstrate that those humans, which were of the Homo sapiens, did begin to observe some of these practices. So what does that tell us? It tells us that the early human groups, of which there were many, and the group that outlasted them all and blended with them to some degree, the Homo sapiens, learned to practice certain ways that we associate with spiritual observations. And these societies would have been hunter-gatherer groups. And what we know for sure is that their early experience of what we might just say are wow experiences were probably those that were found following the herd or following the animal that they hunted. And in these experiences, these wow experiences, were the roots of spiritual movement. And I would say maybe even the early experiences of oneness. There's something beyond themselves, something beyond the tribe, something beyond what they could see. There was some way that they were in touch with something bigger. That at the very least, they were wow experiences. Now, how do we know this? Well, we know this by studying groups and primitive tribes that still have some of these practices. The earliest spiritual practices were probably animism, which was the idea that things were animated. Everything had its own kind of spirit. In Japanese, for example, it was called kami, K-A-M-I, kami. And the interesting about kami is not a word that refers so much. It's sometimes translated as spirit or God. But what it really means is wow. To come in contact with something that draws you out of yourself into a larger perspective. That's what that meant. And along with these wow experiences, they began to make a connection between the animals they were hunting and themselves. We call this totemism. And they began to believe that there was a way to connect with events that had not happened yet, a sort of magical sort of practice. And so this wow experience, which gives birth to this animistic approach and the totem experience that followed from there, it began to create something new in these early humans. Something that would create a cohesiveness, not just for themselves as individuals, but as a group. And when humans began to finally move into the agricultural lifestyle in the Neolithic period, and they began to practice animal husbandry, that same wow experience was now sort of brought into an even larger sort of experience that went beyond just the thrill of the hunt. And that migratory existence, to becoming more settled and sort of seeing the miraculous, not in the totem animal, but to see it in the plant that they needed to survive. When they would cast the seed into the ground and the seed would grow and they could develop huge, you know, civilizations, they began to see that wow in that process as well. And so that's why down to this day, I believe that humans have two orientations when it comes to this experience of the transcendent, of this wonder of something larger, of oneness. And we usually do it as some sort of exhilarating experience of wow, or it's a gradual growth, where our daily practice of nurturing that seed finally moves into blossom. Now, why did I bring those together? When we look at that quote by William James, the belief that there's an unseen order and that our supreme good lies in harmoniously adjusting ourselves to it, this became even stronger in the Neolithic period, where they began to follow the cycles of the seasons, with the cycles of planting, the cycles of harvesting, and surviving in between liminal periods. And along with this, they began to strengthen their communal character. And this offered them a practice where they could go together and return to the source of an ethos. And that this common return and this cultural custom is what gave their society a foundation. It's what allowed them to live together and allowed them to expand. And so what I'm saying is this, that numinous experience of our tribal human ancestors, which moved into the agricultural experience of our human ancestors. This foundation, which if you want to call it religion or call it spirituality, was a way for us to have a common sense of what life meant. It was a way for us to have a common goal. It was a way for us to know how we should treat each other and why we should. It was a way to bring together how things work with why they matter. And when you have this cultural commitment, you reaffirm all of those things. And here's the problem for us. And I believe in some ways it could explain some of the issues that we're all experiencing right now. We don't really have that anymore. We don't really have a common good. We don't have that cohesiveness that brings to a culture and to a society. I mean, think about it. These days, most people don't attend a weekly service of spiritual practice. You know, the 1 hour a week where you gathered together and affirmed your common cultural goals and your common ethos of how you should treat each other. And just a weekly dose of some wisdom. We don't have that. And so we begin to scramble to find other things that will bring us that kind of bringing together. And the problem is that familial or political loyalties will never accomplish this. This will never be accomplished in a secular fashion. And by secular, I mean a fashion that is antithetical to spiritual. It will never happen. It will not happen. And what we will find is a lot of what we have now, where people are going to argue for certain ideals. But there's no spiritual underpinning. We live today in a place where the secular world is trying to replace religion, and all that's giving us is all the worst aspects of it. Where we are judgmental, where we go in mobs to burn people at the stake. And there is no forgiveness. I mean, at least in the old ways, there was grace. And so we must find another language. We must find another way to have this common bond. And I believe that is the language and teachings of oneness. The beauty of these teachings, the beauty of these teachings oneness allows us to bring together today both of those worlds of how things work and why they matter as one. It allows for us to develop a common ethos. It allows for us to have a common practice in the discipline of realizing that if we don't have those practices, if not daily, at least weekly, that we need these things as human beings and that we can't live without them. And if we destroy a church or we destroy a religious system without any awareness of this need, that need will be filled. And it'll be filled with cult-like, graceless activity, which will never satisfy. Will never satisfy. So how do we do that? So if I'm saying, you know, this is this one view, the ego self, which is limited, which is, you know, blind to the larger perspective and arrogant in its hubris, and I'm offering the possibility that that is not the case, that our true nature is boundless, a humble holiness that recognizes the oneness of all life. How do you nurture that? How do you do that? Well, the way that it was done in our tradition was through the practice of what we call in the four direction system of mindfulness, the very first real practice. And that is the practice of reorientation meditation. It's the practice of establishing a centering space and centering objects, and the practice of a daily cycle, morning and evening, of taking time to reaffirm that view that the true nature of self is boundless, is interconnected. And it's so important to have certain sort of practices like this, because otherwise it kind of stops at the intellectual. So even if a person can conceive of oneness and maybe even have their own glimpses of it, if that isn't brought into some sort of practice, Well, it's like our ancient ancestors observing lightning and hitting a tree or causing a fire. And, you know, you went and you grabbed some of that fire and you had that for a little while. But then if you didn't nurture that flame, if you didn't cultivate it, when the flame dies out, then you got to wait for another lightning strike. So the practice of what we call liturgy, the practice of ritual, is a way to bring this understanding into your life, to embody it. Because when you're doing the liturgical practice, whether it's offering incense, whether it's meditation in seated position, or whether it's chanting together, all of these things rely not so much on a belief, but a practice. And we realize the cosmic reality within ourselves and within our community. And we do this, we bring this reality into our lives with ritual. And we learn to trust in the integrity of the practice. And by integrity, I mean the way with which it integrates everything. Everything about us as human beings. And it becomes the practice of realization through ritual. We have faith in the form. Because the practice is not to achieve something. It's to realize something. And our true nature, our notion of self, when properly understood, leads naturally to an inherent sense of interconnectedness. And when I do that each day, when I get up in the morning and the very first thing I do is I go to my sacred space and I bow and I take refuge and that boundless self that we call Buddha, that boundless true nature, which is not just one with the universe, but is the universe. And in the evening, before I go to sleep, during that same practice, it allows me to have a different view of myself. And that different view of myself allows me to have a different way of being and doing. A way that is born out of wisdom and its fruit is compassion. Now, as I've said before in the other talks, each of the principles of oneness are going to meet both the existential and essential need of humans. And I want to give you an example of this. So let's say we have a person who she has gone out and tried to do something. Maybe it's a job. Maybe it's a relationship. Whatever it is, whatever endeavor, whatever enterprise she has taken, it doesn't work. It fails. Her attempts fail. Now, if she believes that all there is her ego self, well, then she's going to be a very unhappy person. Because when we live out of the ego self is bound. It's bound by time. It's bound by space. And if we're living out of the ego self, when we fail, we believe that the whole system is shut. We believe that when we fail at something, it says something about our very being. And you know this is true. In larger society that does not have a spiritual underpinning, believe me, you, that's the only way that you have any value or worth, what you can produce. and how well you succeed. And we worship fame and fortune. Why? Well, because if you're living out of the ego self, that's the only way to define it. And if you don't have fame and you don't have fortune, then you're a failure. And you're worth nothing. And that's what it says. And unless we have some spiritual foundation that offers us another view, that's what we're blindly all doing. But she's not your ordinary person. She is awakened to the oneness of all life. So she knows, because of her daily practice of taking refuge in her true self, that boundless self, the source of her wisdom, the source of her compassion, the source of her creativity, the source of her connectedness, she knows that no matter how many times she fails in the world of the ego, that that is her true foundation, that she is a Buddha. And so whether or not things go well for her or they go bad for her, it says nothing about who she is. It says nothing about her worth or her value, because she now knows that is an inherent thing that cannot be added to nor subtracted from by what we do or don't do, by what we have or don't have. And this is a radical position. Because once you adopt this and you integrate it, not just as an idea, but a bodily practice, you reorient yourself so that no matter how far you fall, your true ground never changes. So that's the existential approach. She wants to do well. She hopes things work out. But she knows sometimes they won't. And she knows that all the things that she's able to do and accomplish someday will disappear. And so she starts and ends her day with that thought. The essential example is our other practitioner. He regularly exposes himself to oneness. And he does this not just through his spiritual practices, but he nurtures it by watching and learning about this wondrous universe. He's constantly exposing himself to the cosmic perspective. He exposes himself to the light of that perspective. So that, you know, let's say that even his experience of watching a show about the cosmos could cause him to have a transcendent wonder. That watching a television show about the magnificent miracle of our existence, which is so rare. One of the things that Buddhists have always taught is that being born as a human being is incredibly rare. There's an old story which says that the odds of being born human are the same as a turtle who lives at the bottom of the ocean and is blind, and who comes to the surface of the ocean once every 1,000 years, and at that very moment that he bursts through the surface, there is a log floating there with a hole in it, and his face, his head goes right through that hole. That's how rare it is. And, you know, people would hear these stories and say, oh, that's cute. It's a cute Buddhist story. It's true. The odds of you being here, the odds of me being here, are 1 in 400 quadrillion. You could argue from a rational perspective, you shouldn't be here. Yet you are. When you start to allow yourself to learn about the cosmic perspective and you bear witness to these things, you can't help but walk away realizing that you are the universe. You can't help it. And when you have that realization and you bring it and embody it in your daily life, it bursts forth the fruits of compassion and connectedness and creativity. We have this lifetime. We have this one lifetime as this particular ego self. One chance, one encounter. We can't waste it. Because there is no one else like you. And there never will be again. And that is the gift. A gift to be shared. And finally, when we enter into this practice, it's really important that we embody it. Because if it just remains an idea, then it's not transformative. As we always say in our four direction system, that the formula is insight plus experimental creative action equals realization. That without the experiment, there is no realization. And the other part of our practice is to not go at life in a way where we're trying to grow, but rather we plunge into our lives, and out of those experiences, we mindfully grow. So that's the important distinction there, that we don't approach our life from some clinical standpoint, but we plunge into our existence, and those experiences we then understand through the insight of oneness, through the insight in the magic of mindfulness. And when we do that, that's when we really grow. That's when we really learn. The example that I think of is someone who is an actor. And this actor wants to present a certain character. And when someone's doing that, it comes across as artificial because they haven't embodied it. Rather, when they pretend to just be that being, they don't have to think about what they're doing anymore. Because they're pretending to be that being. And so that's how they act. And that's how they are. And it's natural. And the same is for us. When we awaken to the oneness of all life and we realize that our true self is this boundlessness, and we're not sure about it at first, but we like an actor pretend that it's true. It becomes who we are. Finally, I'll share a passage from a lay Buddhist practitioner by the name of Jiro Abe. And this comes from his Jiro Abe Santaro, his diary, where he says, "We grow through many ways, and one of these is romantic love. Whether this love succeeds or fails, we still grow. However, to love in order to grow is not real love. It is only an experiment in love. As long as we consciously have growth as our goal, an experiment in love cannot be complete. When neither success nor failure can change this, then for the first time, the experience permeates our very being. And as a result of that kind of love, we grow." And so this practice is not for us to get to some you know, to start viewing our lives as some trail that will lead to some state beyond the warp and woof of existence, but rather we are to be holy divers, to dive and plunge into the depth of our experience and find it there. Oneness is not a concept. Ultimately, oneness is reality.